Welcome to Take Notes on WPSU. I'm Christine Allen. Our guest today is Lucinda Dickens Hawksley, the great-great-great-granddaughter of Charles Dickens. She's also an author in her own right. One of her many books, Dickens's artistic daughter Katie, Her Life, Loves, and Impact, has recently been updated with new information. We'll talk with the author about the triumphs and tragedies of her famous family, and we'll hear two amazing stories about Charles Dickens, one involving Edgar Allan Poe, and the little-known story of how A Christmas Carol came to be written. Lucinda Dickens Hawksley, welcome to Take Note.
Thank you.
Of the many children of Charles and Catherine Dickens, why were you drawn to Katie?
I found Katie so intriguing because when I was little, my family used to own a painting of her. And even then, I knew that it was an unusual painting, even as a child, because she's standing with her back towards the viewer, looking over one shoulder. And even as a child, that impressed me. Now, I didn't realise just what an impact that had on me. And then when I was doing my master's degree in literature and art history, her name just kept coming up. She was married twice, both times to artists. She worked also as an artist model for friends, including John Everett Millais, the great Pre-Raphaelite artist. And I thought then, she really needs a biography. You know, she's just been unfairly forgotten, as happens to so many female artists of this time. It was only when my parents were moving house that I came across some of the things I'd had as a child and a teenager, including a notebook I'd had when I was 13, in which I had life goals. And at the very top, I'd written, write a biography of Kate Perugini. Now, I had thought that idea came to me when I was doing my master's degree, but actually, it had been there ever since I was a child. She's just somebody who, everything I read about her, which wasn't very much because there wasn't much out there, made me realise how interesting she was. And the fact that she was such a good artist, a very well-respected artist in her own time, she made a career and a living out of being an artist, yeah, had been completely forgotten. And that's so frustrating.
You write that Katie Dickens was born when Britain was suffering from its worst ever economic depression. But Charles Dickens was able to do very well in his career very quickly. How did that start?
Really, Dickens was incredibly good at his job as a journalist. Well, many people don't realise that he actually began as a freelance journalist. His very first job, adult job, straight out of school. He'd worked as a child labourer. But when he was 15 and he left school, that was considered adult then, he worked as a solicitor's clerk and he found that really boring. So he taught himself shorthand. After 18 months of working for two different solicitors, he took the brave decision to leave and become a freelance journalist. And he became known for his accuracy. Now, he worked a lot in the parliamentary debates and also in the legal courts, and he wrote a lot about criminal justice system and about politics. And so his name was known a little bit, but not by many people. He wrote his first work of fiction and put it into through the door of a monthly thing called the Monthly Magazine, and that was published anonymously. He wouldn't know if it would be published until he saw the magazine. And through that, he started to write more works of fiction. Then he was spotted by a magazine editor who really liked these little vignettes, what are called sketches of daily life, and commissioned him to write a series of articles. They were known as Sketches by Boz, Boz being his pen name at the time. And through that, this kind of what became known as Bozmania began. Dickens was just incredibly lucky. He wrote in a very fresh, different style. And one of the things that people really liked, which was different from a lot of writers of the time, was that he wrote about everyday situations and everyday people. They weren't just the aristocracy. It wasn't just, you know, gothic tales of castles and princes. It was what we probably call observational comedy today. Dickens would spot interesting things, you know, quirky things about people. And that's really how his fiction began to just gain so much force. And he was staggered by his success. By the time Katie was born, she was born in 1839, just on the cusp of what would become known as the Hungry 40s, when Britain struggled desperately and so much poverty was on the streets. He had, by this point, published what we now know as Sketches by Boz, Pickwick Papers, Oliver Twist, and he was writing Nicholas Nickleby, which was completed around the time that Katie was born. So it had happened in a remarkably short time.
Before I had read your book, I didn't know that Dickens actually suffered from the kind of poverty that he
describes so well in his novels. Tell us about that, what he went through as a child.
Well, Dickens would have been thrilled that you didn't know, because he strove to make sure that people in his own lifetime didn't know. Now that would be something that people would talk about. It wouldn't be seen as shameful at all. But in Dickens's time, this was considered a great shameful thing. So his father was the clerk in the payroll office at the Navy. So it was a good job, middle class job, but he was terrible at living within his means. And he got into really bad debt. And so he was imprisoned. He was arrested and imprisoned in the Marshalsea Debtors Prison. And these were these absolutely ridiculous places where you were imprisoned because you were in debt. You couldn't work because you were in prison and you needed to pay board and lodging. So it was just this extraordinary system. So because Charles's mother and the younger siblings couldn't afford to pay rent either, they all ended up living in the prison cell. So Charles lived by himself. He was just 12 and he worked 10 hours a day, 6 days a week in a factory. And he paid the board and lodging out of his wages for his entire family, as well as his own lodging house fees.
Ironically, I wonder if that experience helped him be so successful.
I think it really did. It drove him, possibly what led him into an early grave, actually. He was very driven by the desperate fear of ever ending up like his father and ever letting his children end up in the way that he had been. So he worked himself to death, as his children believed. He died when he was only 58, and he looked much older. And I think that part of that was the really intense work ethic that began in his childhood. He was haunted his entire life by the spectre of the Marshalsea prison, you know, the fear of the workhouse, which was what many, many people in Victorian England feared. And of course, with Oliver Twist, one of his very first novels, he begins it with Oliver being born in a workhouse and the indignities and iniquity of the workhouse.
How did all these people live in a prison cell? How big were these cells?
Well, I don't imagine they were very big. The Marshalsea was destroyed by the time Dickens was an adult, so I don't actually know how big the cells were, but it would have been pretty miserable. The thing about debtors' prisons were they weren't intended for the absolute poorest of the poor who had no hope of ever paying off their debt. Then you'd just be thrown into, you know, a prison with no chance of coming out. This was meant to shame you if you're kind of lower middle class to upper class. You're meant to shame your friends and family into paying off your debts because they'd be so embarrassed you were in prison. But John Dickens didn't have anybody who could do that. He really wasn't a well-off man and he didn't have those kind of connections.
So I imagine it was all the more wonderful for Charles Dickens to have his own family in his very nice house and be able to provide for them well. And there was trouble later on in the marriage, but it was so much fun in the beginning, it seemed. There were theatricals that happened in the household. Tell us about those.
Yes, well, Dickens wanted to be an actor before he ever planned on being a writer. He really wanted to be another Shakespeare, actually. He wanted to write plays and act in them and travel all around the country and hopefully the world. So he never intended to be the novelist that we know today. He met his wife, Catherine, because she was the daughter of his editor. And you're right, at the beginning, it was a very happy marriage. There was a great deal of love and fun. Catherine also loved amateur dramatics. And in fact, in 1842, the first year they came to America, they also travelled to Canada and they acted on stage together. So when they started having children, Dickens wanted to give this love of acting to his children. And he started to put on, as you said, what was called the family theatricals. Now, these were not just performing a play in your sitting room for your, you know, grandparents at Christmas. This was incredible. They would get people, he would hire, as he described, an army of workmen, carpenters and decorators and things. And the children's schoolroom in the house would be transformed into what Dickens called the smallest theatre in the world. And people would be invited. It was his children, his sisters-in-law, friends of his, which would later include people like Wilkie Collins, the author, the artist Augustus Egg. All sorts of the great and good would come and take part in it. There's a wonderful scene in which Dickens actually hires a policeman, apparently you could do that then, to stand at the door and prevent anyone from gate crashing. They would have professional costumiers and wig makers providing the costumes. He had his friends who were professional artists who would come and paint the backdrop, you know, produce the props. It would have been wonderful. I would love to go back in time and go to a Dickens family theatrical.
And Queen Victoria caught wind of them, I understand, and showed up.
Well, this was when they were performing. They decided to perform on a public stage.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But it was done to raise money for the family of a friend of theirs who had died. He was a playwright called Douglas Jerrold. So they hired a very famous space called the Gallery of Illustration, which was in central London. And Queen Victoria heard about these benefit performances, and they were done very much in the vein of the family theatricals. It was his daughters, his sister-in-law, and various friends and family, and they were selling tickets. Now, this was a big draw. Can you imagine Charles Dickens and his family performing on stage? But it was very much in the vein of the at-home family theatricals. You know, they were not meant to be professionals. Of course, this would have blighted his daughters and sister-in-law's reputation had they been performing in a professional theatre. So they had hired this stage, but it was done very much as a kind of friends and family. But the Queen requested a royal gala performance.
Wow. Oh, that's amazing for those children who had not done anything like that in public to perform for the Queen.
No, absolutely. It must have been terrifying, actually. Can you imagine that, knowing that the royal family was there and you were going to perform this, having never acted on a professional stage before?
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. We're talking with Lucinda Dickens Hawksley, the great-great-great-granddaughter of Charles Dickens. Hawksley is a prolific author with a master's degree in art history. One of her many books, Dickens's artistic daughter, Katie, Her Life, Loves, and Impact, has just been updated with new information. Later on in Katie's life, when she was married to her first husband, Charlie Collins, they had fallen on hard times and she thought about becoming an actress and had a talk with her father about it, and he talked her out of it.
She was a very talented actress, according to contemporary reports. She was offered the chance to go on stage. Now, this would have been a great draw for any theatre. And she went to talk to her father. And he, at this time, as we now know, was in the last relationship of his life, the woman he left his wife for, an actress named Ellen Ternan, who was, rather gallingly for his daughters, the same age as Katie, who was the younger of his two daughters. And Dickens dissuaded her. He said something along the lines of, you know, you have met lots of, you know, very genteel, lovely people from the theatre, because Katie's godfather was the great tragic actor William Charles Macready, very respectable. And he said, but there are people in the industry that would make your hair curl. And he dissuaded her from doing it. Now, Katie at this point was really struggling. Her first husband, Charlie Collins, who was the younger brother of the author Wilkie Collins, was very ill. He'd been mysteriously ill for a long time. And poor man, took a long time before they actually diagnosed that what he was suffering from was stomach cancer. And Katie had been offered this great opportunity. Of course, she hadn't had a chance to build her artistic career by this point. She wasn't really making any money from it at all at this stage in her life. And this was an opportunity that was being offered to her. Dickens said that he would help her. I'm assuming that meant financially. He did indeed give her some money, but this is just 3 days before he died, which neither of them had any idea was coming. He was, as I said before, only 58 years old.
Katie's marriage happened right as her parents' marriage was falling apart. And what did the one have to do with the other?
They're absolutely connected. So in 1857, Charles Dickens met Ellen Ternan, the woman who would become his lover. In 1858, after some very miserable months in the family, he had a public separation from Catherine Dickens, his poor wife, who was then kind of forced out of the family home, essentially. She was given a very decent amount of money, an annuity, and a lovely house to live in, basically on the condition that she keep her mouth shut and not tell everybody about his affairs. And financially, she was fine, but she didn't have her children with her. She only had her eldest son, Charlie. And people often say, oh, Dickens was so cruel that he kept the children. Sadly, that was the law. Catherine had no rights to her children. As a mother, at this time in 1858, she had no rights. The children were the legal property of the father. So Katie was living with her father. She was about to be 19 years old, just at the time that she was thinking about getting married. And until this time, she had been one of the most eligible young women in England. You know, the daughter of the great novelist. Suddenly, there was this huge scandal. And sadly, the scandal attached itself very much to the daughters. Charles and Catherine Dickens had 10 children. They had two surviving daughters, Mamie and Katie. The youngest daughter, baby Dora, died in infancy. And they also had 7 sons, the youngest of whom was only 6 when his parents separated. However, the scandal that attached to the family was much more detrimental to the reputation of daughters than sons. Men could get away with these kind of things. Women really couldn't. It was an extremely sexist, misogynist society. Now, Katie was starting to fight with her father. She adored her father, but she was so angry with him. And she wanted to go and visit her mother, which he tried to stop her from doing. Every time she went to visit Catherine, there would be a row at home. So she essentially decided she needed to escape the family home, mostly to save her relationship with her father. She was in love at the time, or unrequitedly in love, with a friend of her father's who was married, who probably didn't even notice she existed, really. He was called Edmund Yates. He was a magazine editor. When I was writing the book, I found him rather insufferable.
And I can tell from how you how you wrote about him.
I think that's because he broke Katie's heart. I was angry with him. And she really kind of married on the rebound, as it were, from that unrequited affair of the heart. She married a friend, Charlie Collins, Charles Alston Collins, to give him his full name, Pre-Raphaelite artist. And at this point, Katie was at art college doing extremely well and knowing she wanted to be a professional artist. So she thought, wonderful, I'm marrying an artist who, sadly, almost as soon as they got married, decided he was going to be a writer and gave up art altogether, which must have been rather galling. They were very good friends. The marriage, as far as we know, was never consummated. My personal feeling is that Charlie Collins was gay. He was in a terrible, terrible position in Victorian England. To be a what was called a practicing homosexual man was illegal, could lead to imprisonment, could even lead to the death penalty at this time. So there was gay men at this time had no choice but to pretend to be straight. And Katie told her father Charlie ought never to have married. However, you know, there are many different kinds of marriages, and the marriage became a friendship, and this was the same with Katie. She and Charlie became very good friends, and she didn't let the grass grow under her feet. She had love affairs during her marriage.
I was amazed to find out that in Victorian England, it was illegal if you were a man to be a practicing homosexual. If you were a woman, there was no law.
It's probably the only time in history that the law has favoured women over men. I mean, that's the only positive you can take from it. Women were not discriminated against because allegedly Queen Victoria did not believe in lesbians, therefore they didn't exist.
Did she really have that much clout?
Oh, yes.
I guess no one wanted to tell her.
And you know, there's always been this bizarre masculine assumption that what lesbian women do isn't really sex. So it was just something that they could not get their minds around.
Katie was quite an artist. Tell me about her career and your impression of her artwork.
Yes, so Charles and Catherine Dickens were very progressive parents. And in fact, they had both grown up in homes where their own parents were very progressive when it came to education. And one of the things that was really remarkable about Charles and Catherine is that when Katie was about 12, they realised that she was not just a good artist, as every Victorian girl was expected to be able to draw and sketch and paint. However, they realised that this could be a career choice for her. And they sent her to Bedford College, and she was accepted onto the art programme. Now, this is really interesting because Bedford College was the very first college in Britain to educate women to university level. You could not get a degree at this point in England. As a woman, it was illegal. However, you could do all of the work and you would have that knowledge in yourself. They couldn't give you a formal degree. So she had an excellent grounding in art. Not very many female artists had that kind of opportunity. She was growing up in an atmosphere of artistry. A lot of her father's friends were great artists, regularly around the house. So she really got the chance to study looking at the works of some of the greatest artists of her day.
And authors and poets. I was actually keeping a list. I was I have to ask her about Thackeray. And I'll have to ask her about Collins. And I stopped keeping a list because there were too many names after a while in this book. It's full of names everyone will recognize.
Well, that's what's so wonderful. Dickens did have this incredible circle of friends. In fact, I wrote a book called Charles Dickens and His Circle, which could have been the most enormous book I'd ever written.
Yes.
But luckily it was constrained because I was writing it for the National Portrait Gallery in London. So it was constrained by, it had to be able to be accompanied by portraits of people who were in the gallery's collection. Dickens just knew so many people. And as you say, they were interesting people. They were writers, thinkers, academics, you know, radical politicians, activists, all sorts of fascinating people. And so many people from the creative world, you know, music, theatre, art. It was just amazing.
And so after Katie's first husband died, Charlie, she married an artist who was actually very supportive of her for a husband in that era. That seems remarkable.
Yes, Katie's second husband was a man called Carlo Perugini, and they seem to have had a very good marriage. They really adored each other. And as you said, it was a very equal marriage. They had one child. He was very adored and tragically died at a few months old. And this really was what propelled Katie into throwing herself into her art. She didn't have any more children. And Katie, I think, just through her grief, began her painting in earnest. And I think it's no coincidence that, you know, after her child died, that was when she first was accepted to exhibit at the Royal Academy in London, which was still a fairly unusual thing for a female artist to be accepted to do.
And she sold paintings and was able to help support her family.
Yes, it was said that Katie's paintings sold more consistently, but when Carlo sold a painting, he would sell them far less frequently, but for much more money. So he would work on these big canvases that took more time. But Katie's was their bread and butter money. And this was their regular income. She became known for her portraits, mostly of children, probably because she was female and that was what you were expected to do as a female artist.
There are so many great anecdotes in this book, and some of them I just have to ask you about, because I was struck by the Raven story, because here in America, we associate Edgar Allan Poe with ravens. But, well, tell us about Charles Dickens and ravens.
Oh, that was such a wonderful intro, because actually there is a Poe connection. Charles Dickens was quite obsessed with ravens. He had three, possibly even four pet ravens, all given the same name, Grip, one after the other. Now, when Katie was very little, they had Grip the Raven, who, when he decided to steal some white paint, he prized the lids off tins of lead paint and drank the contents, and then spent about 4 days dying and groaning through the lead poisoning that he'd given himself through being a very naughty raven. And Dickens wrote down all his last words, because this was a very intelligent raven that could speak. And he wrote to a friend and he said he was devastated by the death of his raven when the end finally came. The children were rather glad because Grip used to bite them and nip their ankles and fingers, and they didn't realise it was only in play. However, when you look at the size of a raven's beak and the size of a child's hand, I think, mm-hmm. You know, you can understand why they weren't so keen. That very first raven was stuffed, as the Victorians are very fond of taxidermy, placed in a glass case, and Dickens would have him over his desk as he worked. Now, he based Barnaby Rudge's raven Grip on his own raven. So in 1842, Dickens came to America for the first time, and he had received a letter from a young man who said, you know, I'm a writer, and could I come and talk to you about my writing? And Dickens went back and said, yes, Mr. Edgar Allan Poe, please do come to my hotel room. Poe was not known at this time. They got on very well, and Dickens tried to help him with his work. He tried to find him an English publisher, didn't manage to succeed, sadly. And Poe said to him, you know, I love the raven in Barnaby Rudge. Where did you get that inspiration? And Dickens said, well, he's based on my raven. You know, I have a raven who does everything Barnaby's raven does. He hops and he talks and he's very wise. Anyway, then Edgar Allan Poe went on to write The Raven. Now, in fact, in Pennsylvania, you actually have Grip. So if you want to see Grip, he is at the Free Library in Philadelphia in the rare books department. And the reason being that after Dickens' death, when there was a general sale of the house contents, Grip in his glass case was put up for auction. And a fan of Edgar Allan Poe's bought Grip the Raven and brought him to America. And then he was given to, at some point, I'm not sure when, to the Free Library. So if you ask, if you go to the rare books department, they will let you see Grip. And he's still here.
That's absolutely amazing. Here I thought it was Poe who had a raven looking over his shoulder.
You can trace everything back to Dickens. It is extraordinary.
Let me ask you something about your own family. First, tell us about the pony cart accident that almost prevented you from being here today.
Absolutely. That was so strange writing about that. It's one of those moments when you get real chills. So when Catherine was pregnant with the eighth of their children, she went to pick up Charles Dickens from a train that he was coming back by train, and she took the pony cart. And the pony bolted, was frightened by something. And she was in this kind of terrifying situation where the coachman claimed that he was thrown clear of the pony cart, whereas the other servants accused him of having been scared and jumping out. And Catherine was left in this pony carriage with this terrified pony that was careering down the street. And she was heavily pregnant. Anyway, she was rescued. Luckily, a local couple ran out and managed to stop the horse and calm it down. And the baby that she was pregnant with was my great-great-grandfather, who, when he was born, was named Henry Fielding Dickens, after Henry Fielding, the great novelist and reformer who Dickens was a great fan of. And it was a very strange moment writing that book, thinking, gosh, I might not have been here. If that accident had proved more dangerous than it had been, Catherine would have miscarried that baby and none of my side of the family would be here, which is a really strange moment.
And in September of 1876, lucky for you, Henry Dickens married. He married Marie Roche, the granddaughter of a well-known composer, Ignaz Moscheles, a name I'm very familiar with, being a classical music announcer sometimes. Very famous composer. And her mother had been taught by Chopin.
Yes, absolutely. And they had a great friend called Charles Gounod, who you probably know the name of, and he wrote their wedding march, which is still used in the family today, actually. It's a beautiful piece of music. It was a very, very musical family. Sadly, I inherited none of that talent, but I do have some cousins who are still very musical. That's really kind of come down.
How many of you are there, descendants of Charles Dickens?
Oh, there are lots of us.
Oh, my gosh.
But we had a family reunion in 2012, which was the bicentenary of Dickens's birth. Now, at that particular event, there were around 200 family members. That includes partners and stepchildren, mm-hmm. but those were the people who could make it. So, of course, there were people who live overseas or who were working that day. So there are quite a few of us.
And there's one more thing I have to ask you about, which is A Christmas Carol. After Dickens' initial success, he published a couple of things that didn't go over as well. Tell me about how The Christmas Carol happened.
A Christmas Carol is actually 175 years old this year. So its 175th anniversary is the 19th of December. So it's great excitement this year. Dickens had had a difficult year when he started writing it. All of Dickens' novels, not his Christmas books, but all his novels were serialised. They came out in either monthly or weekly instalments. He had been, until this time, on the ascendant. And then for the first time, his readership started to dwindle. And his publishers thought, well, maybe he's just not that good anymore. Maybe his moment has gone. And they started to lose faith in him a little bit. And this, for Dickens, he suffered from depression a lot throughout his life, went back and forth. This was a really tough time for him. He had young children. He was becoming overdrawn at the bank. He was really frightened. Now, he had an idea for writing, well, he initially had an idea to write a pamphlet to tell people about what was happening in terms of child poverty. This would have been a journalistic style work. He had done a lot of campaigning. He talked to a lot of specialists who'd been, you know, looking into the terrible problems of child poverty, and he wanted to make a difference. And then he thought, well, who's going to read this? So he decided that he would write a book that would, in his words, strike a sledgehammer blow in favour of the poor man's child. That was really what A Christmas Carol was meant to say. And he wanted his readers to realise they're all a bit like Scrooge. Everybody who read that book had ignored a poor child at some point because they were everywhere in Britain at that time. He wrote A Christmas Carol despite his publishers thinking that the idea for a Christmas book was a bit weird. They didn't really understand it. They were to be proved very wrong. He had to pretty much self-publish the book. They only paid for some of the costs. He had to pay for the rest of the costs. And the book was published on the 19th of December, 1843. First print run was 6,000 copies. He was furious that the publishers did almost no publicity for it. The book came out to resounding lack of marketing and PR. And yet it sold out within 5 days. By Christmas Eve, it had all been sold out, that first print run, and they had to reprint. From that moment on, Dickens was monumentally famous, and the tradition of the Christmas book and the Christmas story was born. Suddenly, within a year, everybody else was trying to get in on the act. All the other authors were wanting to do it. Dickens was writing his second Christmas book to come out in 1844, and it just began this new Christmas tradition, essentially.
And there were theatrical productions right away?
Yes, for which he got absolutely no money, all pirated. By February of 1844, so 2 months after it had been published, there were at least 3 illegal versions of A Christmas Carol being performed very unseasonably on the London stage. And that was London alone. So all over the country, throughout the world, people were, you know, pirating his works. And this happened every time he published a book. Even sometimes before he'd finished serialising his books, and he hadn't finished writing them, he was writing them as they were serialised, they would be performing stages with guest at endings. It was extraordinary.
Lucinda Dickens Hawksley, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Take Note on WPSU with Lucinda Dickens Hawksley, the great-great-great-granddaughter of Charles Dickens. This month marked the 175th anniversary of the publication of A Christmas Carol. One of Hawksley's many books, Dickens' artistic daughter Katie, her life, loves, and impact, has just been updated with new information. I'm Christine Allen. You'll find a link to Hawksley's work and this program online at wpsu.org/takenote.